Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the STAAR Full Year Results Conference Call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the speaker's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session, at which time, if you wish to ask a question, you'll need to press star one on your telephone. Please be advised that today's conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to your first speaker today, Mr. Matt Bekier. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Addison, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to our conference call. Joined with me today are Greg Hawkins, our Chief Casino Officer, and Harry Theodore, our Chief Commercial Officer. Harry will take over as CFO from Chad Barton by November. Chad's retirement from his role here at the STAAR is the subject of a separate ASX release that we put out this morning. We contextualized that change as part of the organizational consolidation that is underway here at STAAR. I want to take the opportunity to thank Chad for all he's done for us and wish him the very best for his next career step. Well, I hope that you've had the opportunity to read our results, so I'll just keep my comments about 2019 brief because the results are in line with the June 11 announcement. So for the full year, our solid domestic performance was where our EBITDA was up by 5.4%, was offset by a softer VIP market that's giving us normalized EBITDA for the group of $557 million within the range that we have indicated on June 11. And that 557 is 2% down on last year. We declared a dividend of 10 cents for the second half, so the full year dividend is flat on prior year. This expresses the fact that our earnings are solid, our balance sheet is strong, and that we have a very robust domestic business. And, you know, that business has become even stronger now that we've taken decisive action and cost that will set us up well for next year. I'll now focus on what is new and make a couple of points that I think are worth emphasizing. We're happy to take any questions at the end of this call. I'll be touching on 5 points and reference a couple of slides as we go through that. First of all, our trading that we're seeing today, 6 weeks into this financial year, is showing similar patterns to the ones that we described in June last year, with the only difference that we are seeing a little bit of a turnaround and some gentle green shoots appearing. So if I can recap the performance of the second half, we had a solid start in January and first half of February, then demand domestically started to soften. March was worse, April worse, May terrible, June improved, July was better than June, and August is better than July. So we would say that the spend patterns are still of our consumers are still demonstrating a level of caution, but there is clearly more momentum in the market now than there was a quarter ago. In aggregate, we're seeing better belt volumes in the first 6 weeks of this year than we've seen in the fourth quarter of last year. In fact, the volumes are better than, on average, the whole second half. In terms of what's driving this, it's the same forces. So the customer growth from the customers under loyalty is the key engine room for our growth. Weekend cash traffic to the main floor, the sort of business that's probably the best indicator of consumer sentiment, was particularly soft in Q4. And that's now showing some signs of improvement. So on a big weekend, for example, here in Sydney, we would have 44,000 people to the floor. In Q4, that dropped as low as 35,000. We're back in the 40s. So it's a positive turnaround. The VIP business underperformed our expectations throughout the year, but we see that there was really largely broader market conditions and consumer sentiment that drove that performance. In fact, 2019, we recorded a record number of VIP arrivals to our businesses. And we also had a very strong growth in premium bass. It's just that the very large players that we had tended to play at lower levels than they had in the past. As I said, that's really probably an indication of the confidence levels of those customers. Volumes in VIP in the early part of 2020 are up, though I just want to emphasize that are up on last year. It's a very short period of time, 6 weeks. And we know that the VIP business is lumpy, and we've seen it swing around both in terms of volume and win rate over the last few years. Let me move on to the second point. The domestic business is really what's driving this company and has been driving this company. A couple of points under that. First of all, we're holding or gaining share in critical categories. If you go to page number 9 of the presentation, we demonstrate that we have consolidated our market share in slots in Sydney, and we are expanding our market share in Queensland. Page number 10 then shows the longer-term trends in our domestic business. Over the last 5 years, we've grown revenues in the domestic business by 5.1% and expanded EBITDA at 6.8% at a compound level over the same period of time. And that's despite the super tax in Sydney. This means now that the domestic business accounts for 88% of group EBITDA. And our strategy and investment programs continues to be primarily focused on that segment. So I hope that puts a little bit into perspective some of the nervousness about the VIP business. We love the VIP business. We just recognize that it's volatile. The real engine room for us is the domestic business. The third point I want to make is the restructuring that we announced in June 11 has largely been completed. On page number 18, we show the salaried staff reductions that we've pushed through since the program commenced in June. We have reduced headcount in the salaried ranks by 343 staff members, which has generated, or which is generating, a run rate benefit of $40 million to date. So we have gone very fast on that program. $37 million of the 40 is straight salary. The rest are just variable costs like travel, mobile phones, and so on. We're almost done with the program. We expect the number to settle about $45 million at the half. We're now turning our attention to additional non-staff related cost savings. Throughout this period, we've monitored customer engagement and other key metrics, and we are confident that we're managing the risks that come out of a cost reduction program effectively. Overall, if my opinion on this matters, I'd say it's been an exceptionally well-executed program that has now allowed us to really push through the new operating model very, very quickly. The fourth point is that we haven't just looked at our operating costs, we've also worked on our CapEx program. On page 20, we described that we have been able to reduce our forward CapEx spend relative to the guidance we gave in 2018 by $125 million. The main sources of the reductions came from the fact that we have built great facilities, particularly here in Sydney, as interim facilities. The team here has done great work to find ways to redeploy those when the permanent sovereign room opens up, so we don't have to spend the money to upgrade other facilities. We've also done very good work in the IT space and now have a clear roadmap for our IT applications that have allowed us to reduce our IT spend. And because with every new facility that we've commissioned in the Gold Coast and in Sydney, we've been upgrading the infrastructure as we went along. That allows us to reduce our forward CapEx maintenance somehow. I should also say that we've also pushed out a couple of wish list items in the F&B space beyond the five-year planning horizon. In addition to all of this, we'll be testing the market from this half onward to see if there's further opportunities to release capital from supporting assets that we have in the company, such as car parks, for example, and some of the hotel assets that we think we could isolate. That work's underway, and we'll be testing the market, as I said, over the coming months. The last point I want to make is all the other elements of our strategy, particularly the large development programs, are continuing according to plan. The risk profile for those projects will reduce substantially in the coming 8 months. In Sydney, the Sovereign Room was let under a fixed price arrangement, which is progressing to budget and on plan for opening in Q4. In the Gold Coast, Tower 1 is progressing well on a fixed cost arrangement. The funding for this tower has been secured, and the Tower 2 sales are progressing steadily as well. And in Brisbane, Queen's Wharf is in Queen's Wharf, we've let 60% of the total contract sum as a lump sum contract. We're expecting to open the first public amenities in October and let the bridge contract at a fixed price and the fit-out contract at a fixed price as well in FY20. This will mean that the total proportion of the project that will have been completed or be under or is under a fixed price will go up to 88% by the end of this financial year. So we will have fundamentally de-risked Queen's Wharf. So the works are progressing to schedule, and the work to raise debt funding for the project is also progressing well. And we believe, based on the market feedback to date, that there is strong appetite in the market. So those are the 5 points that I wanted to emphasize as part of our results. Let me now turn to the priorities for this financial year, and they're set out on page 27. First of all, we want to implement the organization model, make sure we get our bang for our buck from the organizational capabilities that we've deployed, and can drive that drive above system revenue growth through those capabilities. Secondly, we need to deliver on the development projects. Third, we need to come to hopefully positive resolution on 3 open items that we're working through strategically. And these 3 items are the second Gold Coast casino risk, the tax uncertainty in New South Wales, and the Ritz-Carlton development approvals. We expect to make good progress on all of those in this half. And lastly, you know, we will focus, and this will dominate the day-to-day work, to drive our returns on the capital deployed further up. So those are the priorities for 2020, and these are the key points I wanted to make in my address. I'm now opening up for any questions. So Addison, if you want to go back to the listeners on the phone. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll now begin the question and answer session. If you wish to ask questions, just please press star 1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press the pound or hash key. Your first question is from Matt Ryan from UBS. Please ask.
Hi, Matt. Just looking at the dividend payout ratio, came in at 92%, which is much higher than usual. Can you just talk about, I guess, what the driver was there? Was it just the unlucky VIP turns that you don't think was normal during the period or something else?
Look, when we discussed this with the board yesterday, the view was more that our profits all up are down 2% on last year. We think we have good momentum. We've done, we've taken decisive action on the cost base. We're setting ourselves up well for next year. So, you know, we didn't really see a reason why we should be holding back on the dividend.
Is there any reason why we couldn't see similar numbers in terms of payout ratios moving forward?
Look, the dividend policy is about a year old now, and it says that we are planning to pay out a minimum of 70%, and that dividend policy stays on foot.
I guess just in terms of your CapEx requirements, though, you've got a much better visibility now relative to when you recently changed that dividend payout. So,
yep.
I mean, are you more confident that you can start to pay higher dividends than the minimum 70 that I think is in your guidance?
Look, the minimum is the minimum. And when we came out with it, we said, you know, the minimum goes from 70 to 100. So, you're right about the visibility on the CapEx. We do feel that, you know, for the next 5 years, we have much greater clarity today where we're going to spend the money. And we feel that there's a lot less risk associated with our forward capital spend. We are also starting the work now to see whether there's additional capital we can release from the car parks and potentially some of the other non-core gaming assets to further, you know, release capital. And depending on how successful we are on that front, we can then, you know, form a view as to, you know, whether we should modify our dividend payout policy.
Okay, thanks. And the new disclosure around domestic versus VIP EBITDA, how are you splitting operating costs between the two?
So, Matt, we apportion operating costs based on volume. So when a VIP customer comes to the property obviously services that customer with gaming labour and other operational labour. That gets allocated to the VIP business based on the volumes that are generated. It then has its own cost base in terms of salespeople, management, the jets that are in the business all sit within the VIP business because they're specific labour and assets that relate to that business unit.
Okay, and I think, you know, according to the disclosure that you've given over the past few years, it looks like BIP has contributed somewhere between 10 to 20% of EBITDA. What return do you think you're getting on the capital that you've got in that business at the moment?
That's the interesting thing. So first of all, just quickly, very quickly, just on the operating expenses, you know, so the exercise of cost allocation, as Harry says, is not actually that hard because, you know, we know exactly what labor gets deployed. At the end of the day, there's only about $30 million worth of fixed cost that then gets apportioned, you know, based on EBITDA. So it's not all that hard. In terms of the returns on capital, you know, in terms of really dedicated capital, there's on our reckoning probably less than $400 million worth of capital deployed to the BIP business, and you know that's being expansive, even taking into account the jets that we have. And so if you look at that sort of return of say 60 to 100 on $400 million, it's probably the highest return on asset that we have. But it is so volatile, as you know, that you know. It is just very volatile, and I guess that's why it has to have a high return.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Your next question is from Kane Hannan from Goldman Sachs. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Morning, guys. Just starting on the productivity program and that 40 mil run rate today, expecting to increase to 45 by you know, the first half. Comment on whether that program is, you think that's complete at that point at the 45 mil sort of savings, or whether there's any additional sort of benefits in the second half. And then I suppose how, you know, how the business is being impacted by that headcount reduction, whether, you know, how morale and everything's been trending.
Yeah, so the 45, so this program was very much focused on our fixed cost base. We have about 9,000 staff. Salaried staff is now down to 2,200, and the cost base was focused on that. We feel that with the steps that we've taken, we've now right-sized that cost base, and we feel comfortable that we have an efficient model that we can drive forward. We are not planning to do more in that bucket of cost. What we are working on and continue to work on is on the variable cost. So the work on rostering and, you know, deploying the right labor unit at the right cost to the front line is, you know, a work of a thousand little steps that continues to go ahead and continues to make progress. But this program was focused on the fixed cost, and that's completed. Where we're doing more work is on, you know, other non-labor cost related savings, particularly through procurement, that we can capture. But you know, that's more in the nature of business as usual. So I've told the team internally that the cost cutting is finished substantively, and we are now focusing on driving the business. In terms of the impact, as I said in my introduction, you know, the customer service readings continue to be strong. Probably not surprising because we haven't really done anything about the frontline staff. We continue to look at, you know, the risks that we're taking and the roles that we've removed. You know, not everything's worked perfectly. Of course, some things fall over. But, you know, because we went very quick and hard, it's all behind us now, and I sense that people are moving on. So I used to be in my previous life a management consultant. I've done lots of cost cuttings. This is the best I've ever seen.
Perfect. And then just that VIP trading year to date, comment on whether that, you know, you've seen an improvement in the turn rate in terms of driving that number, or whether that's, you know, more volume visitation driven.
Yeah, look, it's a short period of time, but yes, we've seen the improvement in the turns.
And then looking towards the rest of the year, you know, I know you spoke about, you know, seeing VIP as a, say, a 10% growth business. Comment on what you see as, I suppose, the positive, negative influences that, you know, will impact that 10% number this year. It's obviously a lot of noise in the press at the moment.
Yeah, I might just, you know, I've got Greg Hawkins here. We've got Greg here, who is in charge of that line of business. I might let Greg talk to that.
Sure. I think Matt outlined the context that VIP represents about 12% of our total earnings.
Notwithstanding that, we've had a pretty solid start to the new financial year, which is positive. We're very cognizant of the factors impacting the performance of VIP. There's quite a bit of activity, as you will be aware, happening within the Macau region as well. But generally, Australia has sort of weathered the storms pretty well in terms of inbound VIP demand. So to date, we're tracking well. I think some of the indicators there would be across the previous financial year, the number of customers coming in board as well as the program activations were actually growing, and front money was only down marginally. So we still remain reasonably positive on the business as we look forward. Another insight has been the positive acceptance of Gold Coast as an alternate destination to Sydney. We think that's something that can be added and stimulate further inbound into the market as well. So overall, clearly it's a watch space for us and can be volatile, but volumes to date are solid, and we'll continue to manage a focus on what we need to do to keep that business growing.
Cheers, guys.
Your next question is from Sacha Krien from Events and Partners. Please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. I had a couple of questions about the trading update as well. So just in terms of the reference to improvement, can you just confirm, you're talking there about a sequential improvement on the previous months rather than any year-on-year gains?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And then just secondly, I noticed you included a sort of D&A and finance cost impact from AASB 16, which looks like it's about $11 to $12 million. Can you give us an idea of what the EBITDA impact is going to be from that accounting change? I assume it's going to be a bit of an uplift.
Yeah, it is, Sasha. So there's about $10 million of OPEX that is currently in leases for the business. That then goes and sits on the balance sheet, and you remove the $10 million of OPEX, and then you've got the incremental D&A and interest that we flag on slide 14.
Okay, so you sort of pretty much net out at NPAT level, but EBITDA is going to be higher.
It's a very slight negative at NPAT initially, but then that filters through over time. But EBITDA is roughly $10 million higher, and then $11 million higher in D&A and interest.
Yep, great, thanks. And then question on the early VIP trading. I know it's a very short period of time, but are those volumes benefiting from any low win rate potentially, or is it pretty normal win rate?
Oh, Sasha, we never really comment on that, but let me just say, it's been a very short period of time and the win rate hasn't been great.
Okay. And then final question, I think, just in terms of, I haven't had a chance to look at the account yet, but what have your bad debt expenses done in terms of the VIP business this year versus last year, and what impact was that on the EBITDA number?
Look, they're about $6 million this year, so relatively low and pretty flat to last year, not materially different.
Okay. That's great. Thank you very much.
Your next question is from Larry Gandler from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thanks, guys. Matt, just in terms of your July and August performance, July is, refund checks and fiscal stimulus. Just wondering if you think that has created perhaps a more permanent kick in the consumer pants, or do you think it might be sort of temporary? What you're thinking there, maybe your experience relative to the GFC, if you can reflect upon that?
Well, Larry, the experience from the GFC was that our business is really a consumer confidence business. And if you look at the underlying consumer in Australia right now, actually the household disposable income is not under the pump, right? So rents are down, mortgage payments are down, unemployment is low, people have cash. They're just not confident. And what happened in the GFC was when the $1,000 handout was declared in November, confidence returned very quickly. Now, what we're seeing here is it's a more, for us,
it's a more gradual return to normality, if you want. We really saw a hit to confidence in the fourth quarter, and now it's returning slowly to normality.
Okay, so it seems like though the stimulus had an impact on the performance. Would you agree with that?
Look, it's hard to know because you've got quite a few moving parts, Larry. As Matt said, we've seen two sort of areas of softness. One was your mass visitation to the main gaming floor, particularly here in Sydney. But I think you've got to put that in the context that there was a fair bit of disruption in the second half that rolled off in May. And you're probably getting the benefit now that you've rolled off the disruption. People do turn off at times coming to the property. You might be seeing some benefit of them coming back, but probably also a bit of benefit from some of the uncertainty reducing for some of those mass market customers, as Matt talked about. We also saw a very strong period in the top end of our loyalty customers, the Diamond customers, in the first half.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt talked to some volatility. That came off in that period in the second half, and we've seen a bit of life again in the last couple of months there, which are unlikely to be a segment that's impacted by the forces you're talking about.
And while we're on that same topic, the hold rates in the PGRs around Sydney and Gold Coast would in part be influenced by consumer sentiment and not just luck, as you know. Maybe in terms of the hold rates in those rooms, are you seeing any improvement there?
Look, they can bounce around, but they're at normal levels again, where we would expect them to be this half. So you're right, they will be impacted by average bet and time on device, but there's also month-on-month some luck factor, so you need a longer period of time. But we started the year with hold rates back to what we would normally see in those rooms.
Okay, great. Thanks, guys.
Your next question is from David Fabris from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Hi, Matt. Hi, Harry. Look, I've got a couple of questions here for Harry. So you've almost executed on that cost out program. So in FY20, how should we think about the underlying cost growth? And then secondly, can you talk us through that asset recycling that you've mentioned in the presentation? So what assets are you looking at first? How could this impact it from an operational perspective? And just talk about timing as well. Thank you.
Okay, just on the cost outlook, so it's difficult to really talk about costs without talking to revenue as well. But Matt referenced the domestic earnings slide. So on slide 10, where we show the history of domestic earnings in the presentation pack, if you look at the compound annual growth rate for costs in the domestic business, they've tracked over that five-year period at about 3.4% compared to revenue growth of 5.1%. So we'd say typically over the long term in the domestic business, which you'll appreciate is 90% of the cost base, which is where most of your OPEX is, you know, we've sort of been tracking 1% to 2% below revenue in terms of growth rates on costs. It's not perfect that whole way through, but when we look forward, there's no reason for us to say we can't continue to do that. Now, the only caveat is if you're in a lower revenue growth environment, obviously you've got a fixed cost component, it's harder to do that. But this year we've got some protection because we've obviously taken that $40 million of costs out at the start of the year. So even on flat revenue growth this year, we would expect to see EBITDA growth because of the benefit, or some EBITDA growth based on the benefit of those costs. On the asset recycling, look, strategically we've talked for some time now that we believe we need to maintain ownership of the gaming assets. And if we can provide demand drivers or supporting assets through a more capital light structure, we see merit in that. That was ultimately the driving thinking behind doing mixed use development with our JV partners. When we're looking at the current environment where bond yields are quite low, there's the opportunity, we think, for some of the supporting assets like car parks and some of the hotels, as Matt mentioned, particularly the hotels that will serve mass customers, which are lower volatility and less dependent on a gaming customer. We think they can be monetized and potentially recycle that capital into higher returning areas. Look, as a group,
we're significantly expanding our asset base. Once Queen's Wharf's on, we'll have about 8,000 car spaces, 2,500 hotel rooms across the group, and our asset base, if we do some of the joint venture development in the Gold Coast, will continue to grow beyond that. So whilst there's some immediate opportunities, which is probably the first one we're going to look at, is the car park in Sydney, we also see the potential to recycle more assets as a more substantial opportunity over time, and we're going to be factoring that in as we look at this program. Look, operationally, we will only do it if the supporting assets continue to function in the model where you sell it in a way that supports the gaming assets. So that's not negotiable, but we think there are structures that, you know, you could put forward that do that, and we'll test the market. And if we can find the right operating structure and the right value, then we think it's probably got merit doing it in the current environment.
Okay, that makes sense.
David, just on the expenses. So last year, our expense base was $1.065 billion. Of that, about 65% is labor. Labor, you should just model at basically if nothing happens, we have EBAs that are running on average about 3%. Salary increases are a bit below that, but so number just high twos, it's just labor cost escalation is a good number. The rest of the cost base moves with CPI, which is has 2.2-2.3%. On top of that. From then on, the only thing that really swings around our cost base is whether we pay bonuses or not, and whether we have volume growth in table games and in F&B. A rough estimate would be that you say for every percentage point of growth that you get in F&B and table games, you add $45 million worth of cost to the labor cost. And against that, you offset the productivity increases, which we've now pushed through, and any additional savings that we get out of the non-labor cost base.
Okay, thanks. So that answers the follow-up question I was going to put through, so I appreciate the extra color.
Thank you.
Your next question is from Anthony Longo from CLSA. Please go ahead.
Oh, good morning, Matt. Good morning, Harry. Just a quick one from me. Looking at the VIP business and, I guess, the impact of VIP from the recent press reports on Crown, in the context of that trading update that you've given, I understand the lower actual win rates, but do you think that's possibly a factor as to why are you actually getting some share that may have been going to Crown, do you think?
It's Greg here. Look, I think it's unlikely at this stage. It's pretty early in the trading year to call that out. I'll just reinforce that the junket model, which is a well-established and legal one, obviously in our jurisdictions, is part of the inbound. We have direct customers as well. And another point worth reinforcing is the trending growth in international premium mass business that we have has been quite significant. In fact, for the financial year just finished, that grew by around 20% and had turnover of around $2 billion in itself. So I think that's a positive for us as we see some of the broader pressures on VIP in Macau, whether it's flattening being offset by some of that premium mass, and we're seeing that trend here as well. So that IPM inbound business is quite a strategic focus for us moving forward, and we've seen certainly positive growth and expect that to continue.
Great. Okay, great. Thank you. Second one from me, I just wanted to get a sense for some of the JV partners. So in the past, can you possibly remind me as to how some of those approvals have gone for Chow Tai Fook and Far East in New South Wales and Queensland?
In relation to their shareholding, I'm assuming, Anthony. So Chow Tai Fook and Far East went through a probity review by the Queensland regulator in order to invest in Queen's Wharf. So they're obviously combined a 50% shareholder in the Queen's Wharf development and asset. As part of that, they've been through a full probity review reflecting that ownership proportion. We, as part of the shareholding they took in April last year, they've subsequently also made an application to both the New South Wales and Queensland regulator to increase their shareholding at the star level above 10%. That application is ongoing. And we don't get a lot of visibility into the timing, but you know they continue to work with the regulators around getting that approval.
Yeah, right. I guess the follow-up to that was that I think in the context of where the share price has gone over the past 6 to 9 months, call it, I would have thought that at these levels that they certainly would like to be upping their stake. So I just wanted to get a bit more colour on that.
At the current levels, I was hoping that all of the investors would want to up their stakes.
Absolutely. Sorry, and still look on the JV partners. I remember at that that investor day that you did up in Queensland, I still recall you mentioned an annualised EBITDA benefit of about 30 mil if you had a 1% penetration rate. What sort of signs are we seeing? Are we starting to leverage those relationships as yet? And what sort of benefits are you starting to see flow through? Or is that more an FY20, FY21 story?
It's really an FY22 story because we don't have enough hotel rooms right now. So we're really trying, you know, the way into that customer base is through the non-gaming assets. And that's what we're trying to market. We've now established programs. We have had a couple of marketing pilots into the charter for customer base. It's fair to say that the results for us have so far been not great. We really haven't had enough cut through. Now, you know, the tourism travel to Australia out of China has slowed down as well, so it hasn't been probably the best time to test it. We will continue to work on that and make sure that by 2022 we have a program that will really allow us to fire up that customer base.
Great, no, thank you. And sorry, while I've got the floor, just last question on from me. Just on the CapEx numbers, it looked like they've come down a little bit in terms of what they were previously. Are you able to give a sense as to what some of those catalysts are as to why that's come down? And apologies, I probably had limited time to look through the preso this morning, but you just want to get a sense as to if that's a function of, I guess, increasing the proportion of fixed contract work, or is it sort of reduced scope or some other things that you've managed to... I guess price more effectively.
I'll have a go, Anthony, and Matt can add to it. So Matt referenced some of the drivers in his opening comments, but really there's four buckets that have driven the reduced forward guidance on CapEx. The first one is we've done a lot of work around planning in Sydney, and the best plan in terms of the capital we're going to spend on the property and the returns we're going to generate. And as part of Sovereign Room being delivered later this financial year, that's freeing up the temporary Sovereign Room and some other assets. And we've decided in terms of our forward spend to reprioritize those assets to other tiers. So when the platinum and diamond customers move up to the new Sovereign Room, we're repurposing the temporary Sovereign Room to get an upgrade to the gold customers, and then the Oasis rooms and upgrade to the next tier down. So, you know, as part of that CapEx, we are giving each of the customers a significant step up in terms of scale and quality of room in a more capital light way. That's one of the drivers of some of the reduction. Matt talked about IT and some of the platforms. There was some spend there that as we've been through where sort of our highest returning spend is, we're going to keep some of the platforms and really prioritize our spend just on customer facing initiatives. And that's been some of the reduction. And then you've sort of got some reduced maintenance as well. That really reflects over the last couple of years, we've come off a peak level of spend. And we now have, particularly in the Gold Coast and Sydney, fresh properties where all of our rooms have been refreshed, a lot of public areas, got a fresh gaming floor and gaming product. You know, we think we're in a position to leverage that and have lower spend on maintenance and some of the other areas for a time now where we still are delivering big growth projects that are going to deliver appropriate returns.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very much, everyone.
Your next question is from Rohan Sundram from MST. Please ask.
Morning, Matt. Morning, Harry. Just a question around the Ritz-Carlton. Are you able to shed a bit of light on what the alternatives might be around that in your planning and your proposal?
Yes, look, so the Ritz-Carlton, the status is that on the 27th of August, the public hearing will conclude the presentations and the interactions with the Independent Planning Commission here.
they then have 28 days to work out what their recommendation is, and we'll see where we go with that. That's a current plan, and I have to emphasize, we continue to be totally committed to this project. Right? This is a great project. We think we are absolutely convinced that we've done everything that can be done and should be done to get the right approvals. And unfortunately, you know, we're being caught up here in some dark and murky politics that have thrown us a bit of a wobbly. But we'll continue to pursue that. You know, if the Ritz-Carlton doesn't get up in its current form, we'll have to see what the Planning Commission comes back with, whether there is a compromised position that they put to us, or, you know, whether there's a different planning regime that's going to be now put forward and accelerated that then pushes out that tower by a year or two till that planning regime is settled. That's probably the primary one. In the meantime, we are very focused on just making sure that the Sovereign Room gets completed. The Sovereign Room competitively is the most important asset for us when Crown opens up. We have, as you know, we've got the Darling as the five-star hotel, Forbes five-star hotel. That's a very competitive asset. So I don't think we're sort of disadvantaged there. The Sovereign Room that we need to push more than anything else.
Sure. Is there potential for an alternate site in Darling Harbour for Ritz-Carlton, or are you just going to work with what you're given at the moment?
Look, if this tower doesn't get up, it's very hard. There's not actually that many pieces of land in Piedmont or Darling Harbour that are large enough to accommodate a tower of that height. Our town planners and architects have done comprehensive studies, and there's, you know, Piedmont is pretty heavily overbuilt as it is, so there's not that much land available. If it's not on site or directly adjacent, I'm not interested in building a hotel. Right, so it's got to be feeding the asset directly, otherwise we're not that interested. We do have some alternatives, but I don't really want to go too far down the track. Right now, we continue to be totally committed to push the Ritz-Carlton as far as we can, the Ritz-Carlton on our side as far as we can.
Okay, understood. And just last question from me, where's the potential to do more around VIP in the Gold Coast? Is it at the property level, or do you need more buy-in from governments or the like?
I'm not sure. What do you mean? So, I mean,
Greg mentioned there was potential to maybe there's more scope to see further uplifts in Gold Coast in VIP. Is that to do with any refurb activity, or is there just more marketing efforts, or what does that involve in particular?
Yeah, I think it's more the latter. So I think we're very happy with the capital allocated and the level of amenity up there now, which is fantastic to cater for that type of business. So the reality then is exposing and marketing that property now more aggressively once it's established to our customer base. And we had a good example of that over the last couple of months as well. So then the word of mouth and the direct marketing will continue. So it's more about our channels of activation, and we see that as being very positive.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question is again from Sacha Krien from Evans and Partners. Please go ahead.
Hi guys, sorry, very quick follow-up. Just in terms of the asset sales, Harry, just wondering if there's going to be a gearing benefit from these asset sales in terms of the way ratings agencies look at your gearing. And then secondly, will you sell assets if the sale is not earnings accretive, or is there a prospect that some of these sales might end up being a little bit earnings dilutive?
Look, we'd expect it to be accretive. It'll all come down to the value and the operating arrangements around it, Sasha. But, you know, we're only going to do it if we get the right value for these assets, and in which case we'd expect it to be accretive. And on the gearing side, it'll all be linked to how much value you get for the individual asset relative to the earnings.
Yeah. But is it the case, though, that the ratings agencies, I mean, is there expected to be a material gearing benefit from this, or is it more a capital allocation question?
In the short term, it's more capital allocation because they're not, you know, in terms of the materiality of the asset base today, if you look at the car park in Sydney, that's not really going to drive a material difference to gearing. It's more about just, you know, what value we can achieve for that asset and what we can do with that capital. And as we get through Queen's Wharf, you know, that gives you a much bigger and more material opportunity to recycle a lot of capital. And so we're sort of going to test the market on the structures and whether the value stacks up for us, because it's a bigger opportunity long term as well.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
And we have a question from Larry Gandler from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Just a follow-up question from me, or two actually. VIP, Judge Bergen's inquiry. Just wondering if you guys will be making submissions. I imagine you will. And can you describe how you today approve junkets? I imagine it's an internal due diligence. And could you imagine a regime where, perhaps like Singapore, where ILGA would need to conduct its own approval process for junkets?
So, Larry, you need to clarify the first question. I'm not aware. What's the inquiry you're referencing?
ILGA's independent inquiry into, I guess it's really into the Crown's, the accusations made by the media against Crown. I understand that specific to Crown, but I think she's probably going to do a review of the entire VIP industry and then make recommendations.
So, as we understand it, the inquiry is not set up as an industry-wide inquiry.
Okay.
The inquiry is focused on Crown, and I thought it had two legs. One leg, you know, you should ask Crown next week, but one leg is focused on the acquisition of shares by Melco, and the second
yep.
leg is the broad sort of catch-all around the allegations made by Channel 9 and Fairfax. So,
right.
But we are not, as we understand it, we haven't been contacted, we haven't been approached by ILGA on that at all. In terms of the junkets, we are currently operating under two regimes in our business. In New South Wales, we have the delegations from ILGA to approve junkets under a strict set of conditions that provide our operating procedures, and ILGA has visibility over that and monitors the compliance with those conditions. In Queensland, the regulator licenses junkets, not us.
Right. Okay, that's good. Okay, so the regulator is licensing junkets. How does the regulator in Queensland do its diligence?
Same way we do it. You know, we have the same. They have access to the same information. They request.
Yeah. So their inputs, similar to ours, are by nature of running appropriate global checks through various forms to flag any issues, and then if there's issues flagged, that has a deeper formalised investigation that follows that. And of course, then liaising with relevant federal authorities, including AFP, if there's any alerts that are identified. So the regimen and rigour applied to approvals, both by us and on our behalf in Queensland, is very deep. And obviously, we apply then an overlay to ensure those checks are not just done once, but done on a regular basis. So from our point of view, as you would expect, it's extremely thorough and rigorously maintained.
Okay. On international premium mass, again, just remind me, that business is unlikely to be largely a China contingent customer because it's difficult for them. These people are not playing on credit. They're constrained on how much capital they can travel with. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, that's generally right. So we're seeing growth in that international premium mass business across all product types, being table games and slots.
Mm-hmm.
And generally, those customers are either cash carrying or check or have the ability to TT funds to us. As I said, they're really airfare and comp-based programs as opposed to commission-based programs. So that enables us to have a pretty solid margin that comes out of that business. And I think in line with general trends across the sector, we see more customers at a lower level from an international perspective being a positive for us, and it's one that we're resourcing to continue to grow.
And Larry, I just would you want to add, that's where, you know, our strategy of building out hotel assets, getting more hotel capacity, that's why we need it, right? Because that for us is a sweet spot. If we were reliant just a few, a handful of whales to drive the VIP business, we wouldn't need all these, we would not need all these additional hotel rooms. And so we look at that as a critical part of a very sustainable long-term growth strategy.
And some of these players can play under the 10% tax rate?
They all play under the 10% tax rate.
They all play under the 10% tax rate, okay.
Well, all, as long as they meet the requirements. But
they have to sign up to a program and play with a particular chipset. If they do that, then they fall under the 10%.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks.
We don't have any other questions as of the moment. Presenters,
right.
Please continue.
Edison, I think if there's no further questions, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. We'll be doing the rounds over the next few days, meeting with many of you. So if there's any additional questions, please reach out to us. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude our call for today. Thank you for participating. You may all disconnect.
Thank you.